Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are going to be talking today about bringing awareness, those through who have lived experiences of injustices. As many of you know, I've been interviewing Franz Dow, former warden, 27-year warden from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam. And I've also been interviewing people like Michael Johnson, who is a lieutenant with the Department of Corrections in Montana, Donald J. Vodica, a 14-year veteran with one of the biggest prisons in California, who ended up exposing his peers, being on the run for a while, and he has since written a book, The Green Wall, which you can find on the internet. I've also interviewed Mariam Jacobs, who is a psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands. I've interviewed Brian Winters, who is a former politician, now founder of American Union, which advocates for mass incarceration and immigration and other issues that go on in the United States. Brian Winters is from Vermont. Vermont and Maine are the only two, other than D.C., who have never taken away the rights of prisoners to vote. They have never taken the right of prisoners to vote, which every other state in the United States has. We've talked about a lot of things, and we've interviewed Denise Careful from Society First out of Florida. We've interviewed a lot of former prisoners and current prisoners throughout the country. We've interviewed prisoners in the Netherlands, in Brussels, Belgium. We've interviewed a consul from London. We've interviewed a lot of people throughout the country and throughout the world who have been on this show talking about the injustices that go on in the United States prisons. I want everyone to know, many people have stereotyped. Members of society have stereotyped. Everyone in prison is supposed to be the same, hardcore criminals. One of the things we're going to talk about today is justice, not just from the penal system, not just from our government, but from families and friends of the incarcerated. Many people are incarcerated because they never had family in the first place to support them. Many prisoners, and we all have to realize, we have a serious, serious problem in the United States of mental illnesses and addictions. And one of the things that we fail to realize when we talk about mental illnesses is that mental illnesses does not mean just retardation. Mental illnesses means results of traumas, childhood traumas, adolescent traumas, young, middle-aged, and elderly men and women traumas. We have people who have been violated as children, who have been abused as children, those who have been raised in infested drug and alcohol environments, those who have been brought up in domestic violent home situations. I'm going to tell you some things that I want to say, and I'm going to tell everyone listening to this today, we don't need to judge others. We need to remember, though, that there are victims behind those prison walls. We have wrongfully convicted in the prisons throughout the country. We have first-time offenders who were victims who became offenders. And whether family want to admit it or not, a lot of these people in prison were violated by their own family members or by in-laws. Or they were violated in some other way. And a family cannot stick together with these people that have been violated and have resulted in prison, then families were not there in the first place to support them. I remember when my father died, I was 17 years old. 17 years old, my mother had 9 children. One of them, the oldest, the male, moved out. 4 years older than me. So not only did I have to finish high school, but being the only one at home of the oldest, and having my driver's license, I ended up staying with my mother and taking care of my siblings. I spent my life taking care of my siblings. I remember one of my cars by my youngest brother, letting him use it, and he had an accident with it. Another brother that just got out of the Marines borrowed my car, and it was a new Toyota. I'll never forget. Got smashed up. I remember loaning money to family members. There was a lot I was doing, and I'm not just saying this to get pity. I'm not getting this to say get attention. What I'm trying to say is people wake up. Because the people I've interviewed throughout the country and the world have come on this show, and we're going to be having on April 2nd at 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, 8 o'clock in the Netherlands, we're going to be having a show. It's going to be bringing people from all over the world on. What we're going to be trying to do is a project that hasn't been done before, and that is to bring everyone together to hold a virtual conference to discuss challenging our legislative members, our government, throughout the countries, to have 1 year, every 3 years to 5 years, to have a convention or a conference to go over the issues of mass incarceration in the United States, to talk about ways that we can learn something from these other countries. Franz Dahl, a 27-year warden, works with the United Nations. He works with the global international Ministry of Psychiatry. He works with the International Red Cross. He's been in the United States prisons. He's been in Massachusetts prisons. He's been in New York prisons. He's currently working in Texas with Gary Cohen, a criminal defense lawyer, on some other projects and issues that are going on there. Franz Dahl has brought a lot of his former prisoners on the show who are now successful, who have written books. They're authors. They have organizations. Frank DeBrine is one. He has talked about the way he treated the prisoners in his time. He would actually take time to meet with the prisoners, to talk with them. Franz Dahl stated, if you treat the prisoners with dignity, you respect them, you're going to get respect back. He talked about the programs that they have. He talked about the housing that they had. Miriam Jacobs, she wrote a book, Suspended Values in Concentration Camps in Prison, comparing concentration camps to the United States prisons. A lot of you don't realize what goes on behind those prison walls. I started New Vision Organization in 2004. We were advocating for prisoners nationwide, men, women, and youth across the country. I registered the organization with the universities around the country, and we had law students volunteering, paralegals, political science majors, psychology majors, social worker majors. They were doing it for nothing because they wanted to get their internships. Many of them wanted to get the experience. Many of them had relatives that or friends that were incarcerated. When you see organizations out here today, nonprofit organizations that are getting funding and turning people down when they need help in prison, you know that they're in for a motive, and it sure isn't to help the incarcerated. Going back to my own loved one, all these years, I couldn't put myself up to reading the transcripts. And I'll tell you, for somebody going all the way back 30 years, when somebody has a traumatic situation happen, not just from the loved one that made the mistake, that committed the offense, but the parent or the parents themselves. You live in just to put it mildly, you really don't know what's going on around you. You're talking, you think you're thinking, and you think you're talking. I left the country. She was a former Department of Social Services director, area director, Linda Van Essendahl. I went to her. Somebody told me to go see Linda. This is when I came out of a hospital. I had to attempt suicide. Linda asked me what I was going to do when my son graduated from college, what was my plan? Well, I had two bedrooms added down in my basement in the living room. I was working on the kitchenette when all of this happened. So I told her I wanted to travel. I had planned on traveling, and I was going to rent half the house out. And I figured if my son wanted to rent the other, take the other half, or if he didn't, he could do what he wanted to do and rent the top half. I left the country. I went to a Mayan Indian school in the mountains of Quetzaltenango, Guatemala. I met up with a friend of mine who I made friends with at the school, Martha. Martha and I traveled from El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, and then I had applied before I even left the States to do some missionary work in Africa. They contacted me while I was at this Mayan Indian school to see if I wanted to, still wanted to do it. And I said, yes. I didn't want to go back to the United States, though. So they met with me at the school I was going to, Central Maya, Didiomas. They did the interview. And I said I wanted to do some missionary work in Africa. So they said I would have to come back to the States. I would have to come back to the States for the orientation. So I came back to the States. And I was staying with a friend of mine, Nzinga, from Atlanta, Georgia. And Nzinga and her friend, Fatima, told me the safest place to go to do the type of work or to even go there was Ghana, West Africa. They said that Ghana, West Africa was an only speaking, was a English-speaking country, and it was one of the safest countries in the world. And Fatima's father, her parents were there. So they picked me up at the airport when I got there. And then I happened to meet a girl. She was related to the second deputy speaker at the Parliament House, Dr. S.B. Arthur. So I got to go to the Parliament House, and I met with Dr. S.B. Arthur. I also met with first deputy speaker, Kenneth Gerasse. Dr. Arthur gave me a project to do in his hometown, the town he grew up in, or the region he grew up in, Mwenchi. So I started New Vision Organization out in Ghana, West Africa, but it wasn't advocating for the incarcerated. It was actually doing some work in the villages. We came across a young girl. Her name was Akua. Akua had a massive tumor. She was 21 years old with a massive tumor on her face. Found her in the bush, in the woods, with a baby near death, Kofi. She was trying to feed the baby. And she was half dead herself. So we got her back to Kalibu Hospital. We got the baby in the hospital. They wouldn't take her because of the massive tumor on her face. So I took her to the guest house that I was at. She slept in my bed and I slept in the chair. And the next day I took her back to the hospital and I didn't leave until I made sure they took her. And I paid for the pillows and the blankets and everything else. In the meantime, my loved one had left the country when a fatal shot was fired 30 years ago. I later learned he felt he did not belong in the United States because of all the racism. And I'm going to tell you, I'm somebody that knows about racism. My mother was Lebanese. My mother had me. She had my oldest brother and me by a man, her brother, brought home, a black man. My brother was accepted at first, and then when she got pregnant with me by the same man, and she loved this man, but he was married. And he was supposed to be teaching her how to drive, believe it or not. But she became an outcast, and she had a friend. Her friend was also Lebanese and Italian. And she was married to a Mexican man. And they were living on Cape Cod in Osterville. So she had my mother move out there. And there was this little shed next to her house, which my mother was in, with my four-year-old brother and me in her womb, in her stomach. And there was a man that lived down the street. He came from Cape Verde Islands when he was 14 years old. Arsenio Lopes, an older man from Falmouth, Massachusetts, brought him over. And this man, Arthur Brando, went into the war, World War II. When he came out, he had bought that house. And he would drive by going to the store to pick something up, and he saw my mother struggling out there by herself with a four-year-old in her and a child in her womb. And he would ask her if there was anything she needed from the store. They became good friends. And when it was near time for me to be born, my mother was going to give me up for adoption, and she was going to give up her four-year-old son to the biological father because he and his wife had a daughter, but they couldn't have any more children, and they wanted a son. Arthur Brando told my mother if she would marry him, he would adopt my brother and me, which she did. We had a beautiful family growing up. My aunt and uncle moved in with us, and as they say, two women can't get along, so my father turned half the house over to my uncle, his brother, and my father built a house further down on the same street, built another house where we grew up, and where I had my own home built years later when I was able to have a place to stay. My father, we were not rich, but my father left plenty of land, and he had an excellent reputation in the town of Osterville. And I'm going to tell you, that reputation, that made me the person I am, because our reputation meant a lot to us. But I'm going to go back to the prison issues and stumbling, because I'm a Christian, and I'll tell you, in the book of Ephesians, in the Bible, Ephesians 12, in the book of Ephesians chapter 6, I believe it is, it talks about we are not wrestling against flesh and blood. We are wrestling against powers and principalities, rulers of darkness in high places. This country we live in all these countries around, this is not the world. When we talk about the world, that includes the hemisphere. That includes the heavens. It includes all the planets. Our country and around this country, other countries in this planet, is that's what it is, a planet. We're living in a planet. But again, we're wrestling against powers and principalities and rulers of darkness in high places. So I'm not going to blame anybody. I'm not going to blame any family, because we know that evil spirits are working in families. But I'm going to tell you, my son was violated as a child by an in-law, and that in-law still lives in Osterville in my deceased parents' home. And it was not just my own loved one, my own child, that was violated. It was his own, and it was a niece. It was others in the family. But again, like many people in society today, they rub or hide things under the carpet or in the closet. My son held in for years what happened to him. And it was so bad that we had a puppy that I had gotten for my son, being an only child. He always had a dog. And this puppy one time disappeared. We couldn't find it. It was getting late, so I told my son, tomorrow we'll look for it when I get home from work. My sister called me that day at work and told me they found the puppy. The puppy was dead, which later came out in years that the puppy was poisoned by the very person that violated my child and others. The puppy was poisoned to death as a means of keeping people quiet. I work for the Department of Social Services, and one of the social workers, Debbie, her dog was having puppies. And she told me, she said, Leona, she said, when my dog has the puppies, I'll give one to your son. My son didn't want any more puppies. He didn't want any dogs. But when she had it, I brought my son to DSS, and they had a blanket in front of the picture window in the office, and the puppy was on that blanket. And when my son saw that puppy, he went over and he knelt down and he held that puppy. He named that puppy Louie. And he had that puppy from that day until the day he left the home after a serious bout with depression and committed his first offense. People think when somebody commits a crime that they're hardcore criminals. One of the things I talk about on the radio show all the time is cultures, because people need to know about different cultures. First of all, people also need to know about mental health issues. And in the 24 years I've been advocating for the incarcerated men and women and youth, and interviewing people of all backgrounds, I have learned a lot about mental illnesses and addictions in this country. I have also learned about cultures. Cultures do not necessarily mean just races. It just doesn't mean about colors. You have cultures in your own home. There are people in homes that are not, my mother used to say it, no two individuals are exactly alike. Everybody's different. And cultures also exist in environments. Cape Cod is a place where at one time it was like country. I understand now, I haven't been to the Cape for years, but I understand now the Cape has turned into ghetto too because of the serious, serious bouts, drugs going on in on the Cape, and there's a lot more crime going on in the Cape. But when I was on the Cape and I was raising my son, it was never heard of. The year my son committed his first offense, there was a school teacher that also committed an offense. He set his house on fire with his family in it. I don't know if anyone got hurt, but he ended up, I believe, going to prison. And in Buzzards Bay, at the academy there, there was some people that got in a fight at some club on Main Street in Buzzards Bay, and someone was killed. Those were the three. But I will say, my son started working out and started working when he was 13 years old. I later learned the reason he was so passionate about weightlifting was because it made him strong. It protected him. And no one could mess with him because he could protect himself. He worked since the age of 13. When he graduated from high school, he went away to school, Bridgeton Academy up in North Bridgeton, Maine. When he came back, he ended up going to college for 3 years before going into his fourth year, before he went into severe depression because he finally opened up after 16 years about his situation. The person he told could not be trusted. Sometimes when you go into severe depression, you're not eating, you're not sleeping, you can't function, you give up on everything. And there were people I asked to come to the house to talk to him. One of them was a police officer, a friend of mine, John. And John came to talk to him. He was in his bedroom with the windows shut, the blinds shut, the TV was on, but he wasn't watching it. Severely depressed. And as a psychiatrist said later in the court, in the trial, he was suffering from severe depression. Severe depression. He was suffering from not only severe depression, but it had with psychotic behaviors. You know, when I started New Vision Organization, when I first started advocating, I thought my situation was just by itself, but it turned out that it wasn't. There were people across the country going through the same thing. But when you have friends like Casey Sherman that can lie about something knowing that he had never been involved in a relationship before, his third year in college, to say that they double dated, and other friends on Cape Cod, even now one is a legislative member, but didn't even question it, didn't say anything, knowing that it was not true. And then, leaving the country, there was a police officer, they didn't even send the feds after him. It was local police from the very area that the crime happened. But there was a Freddie Rivers on Cape Cod. He was a police officer, a detective, supposed to be a friend of my brother's and his wife. But then again, it was my brother that married his girlfriend. So all the years they were friends, I wonder now if Freddie Rivers wasn't just doing this to get back at my brother. Or it was after me, because I told him to leave my home one time, because Freddie Rivers has a reputation too, violating his own sister-in-law, his ex-wife's sister, when she was 10 years old, babysitting. He was going backtracking the house and violating her. And to this day, that poor girl, she's in her 60s now, early 60s, has never told her sister about it. But other people know, because I sat at a table with her and with other people who already know what Freddie Rivers is about. He claimed to know my son so he could get a free trip looking for my son. He was going to be able to get a free trip and go to these different places. He did never know my son because he was never introduced to my son, and my son was always away at school. But another lie from someone on Cape Cod. Fred Rivers, former detective. And I will say, as far as the lawyer that I hired to represent my son, Henry Owens thought he was going to win over a house because I mortgaged my house. And all Henry Owens worried about was the money. When my son left the country, he ended up meeting a family, a woman much older than him, with two children. And they did eventually bond. To this day, that woman and those kids, now grown up and having their own children, still love him as much as they did then. They saw the pain he was in. They knew what he was going through. But Henry Owens called this woman and told her not to come to the States, not to go to the trial. He told the psychiatrist not to do the evaluation report. So the psychiatrist was reading from his notes in the courtroom. I asked the psychiatrist years later why he did not write that evaluation up. And he said he was doing what Henry Owens told him to do or not to do. I believe Henry Owens was bought. He was in that court. He was not prepared at all. And he had another lawyer with him, a younger lawyer, that seemed to have been doing all the work. I'm going to be exposing people, and I'll tell you why. Because the last words that were said to my son in the courtroom by one of the sisters was that she hopes he never adjusts while in prison. I recently learned a few years back that this sister worked for the Department of Corrections in the state of Washington. A lawyer, and I'm going to tell you these lawyers. One is Norman Zellkind. Norman Zellkind is from Boston. And Elizabeth Kelly is from Washington State. Trying to get a lawyer has been very difficult for me, because the ex married into a Jewish family, which many of you are familiar with. The name Goldstein goes a long way in a lot of states, and they apparently have gotten the word out. So getting a lawyer for my son has been very difficult. But Norman Zellkind and this Elizabeth Kelly took this case. They met with him one time. I get a Norman Zelkind charged me $4,500 for that one visit. Elizabeth Kelly, $12,000. The sad thing about it is that when the complaint was made to the Bar Association, nothing could be done about it. When I filed a complaint against Elizabeth Kelly in Washington, I learned that she was not licensed to practice in Washington, but her residence was in Washington. On her website, she had that she also practiced in New York. When I contacted New York, they said she wasn't licensed to practice in New York. So some of the advocates helping me finally tracked her down to Ohio. Now in Ohio, she had a license to practice, but no residence. My radio show is to expose, and that's exactly what I'm doing. Now, I'm going to tell you something else. WellPath is a contracted medical provider with the Department of Corrections in Massachusetts, and they're in 36 or 37 states, and there's been over 1,000 lawsuits filed against them. And their prison doctor, Adriana Carrillo, operated on my son, permanently damaging his knee, removing all the cartilages in his knee, removing all the cartilages in his shoulder and cutting into his collarbone. Permanent damage. WellPath has had over 1,000 lawsuits filed against them. The U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren and U.S. Senator Ed Markey just sent a letter out to the WellPath CEOs in Florida and in Tennessee. They are under scrutiny, and the senators were asking them to provide them with all kinds of information, and you can find it on the internet. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Ed Markey scrutinized WellPath. You can type on the internet lawsuits filed against WellPath, over 1,000 lawsuits filed against WellPath. Just type it in like you're writing it on a piece of paper. And also type in, just for the record, type in drugs smuggled in by guards or correctional officers. Because as much as people want everyone to believe that drugs gets into the prisons by prisoners, families, and friends, we had an epidemic. We had a pandemic, coronavirus. For 3 years, no one was allowed to visit anyone in the prisons. But yet, and I'm an advocate, I network with advocates around the country. Yet we know there were prisoners and are prisoners to this day that are strung out on drugs in the prisons. Strung out on drugs in the prisons. A psychologist evaluated my son. Now get this. He put down antisocial behavior, but yet in the trial, the psychologist ruled out antisocial behavior because he saw through all the witnesses who testified on behalf of my son about the depression and about all these other things that he wasn't antisocial. He was suffering from depressive episode with psychotic behaviors. Severe depressive episode with psychotic behaviors. This psychologist in the prison in 2017 evaluated my son with antisocial behavior. He never put down any of the childhood traumas, which, by the way, I'm going to say, when I lived in Florida in 1978-79, my son saw me brutally beaten, which was another trauma because that day was the same day after I got beaten that I put my son on a plane by himself and had my sister pick him up at the airport and bring him to my mother's house, his grandmother. This psychologist at the prison said that the mother, my son's mother and father, was still together, alive and doing well. My son's father was never involved with his son. He visited a few times when my son was little, and my son finally told me one time, "Mommy, he's not coming to visit me. Every time he comes, he's asking who you are with, what you are doing." So this psychologist, when he said that the father and mother were together, alive and well, I went on the internet and I researched for his father. His father died 5 years before that evaluation was done. His father had cancer. His father was from Middleborough. Amos Dias. My son has a cousin who is now his uncle because even his own mother disowned him. But being the woman in the family, her mother and father adopted her son. So her son, who is my son's cousin, became the brother to my son's father. Now, these are things that people have to know about, because when you're trying to evaluate or when you're trying to figure something out, let's get it all out. Let's get it all out. There's no secrets. I'll tell you, nothing can be said or done with me to make me think, feel, or talk any different, because I'm about getting everything out now. As much as people want to hide things under the carpet, as much as people want to pretend it never happened, many want to block it out, but they don't realize there's damage is done to those who are behind those prison walls. There's a lot of things. When my son was 6 years old, 5 years old, his father came to the house at 7 o'clock at night. And I'm sitting at the table. He's sitting at the table talking to me. And it was his son's birthday. He didn't even know it. So I said, why don't you do something with your son? Today's his birthday. He said, oh, what do you want to do? And my son said he wanted to go for Chinese food. So I'm thinking, now this father might bond with his son if I leave. So I went down. I visited my friend Ruth down the street. Ruth Barbosa. I went and visited with her. And I told them I'd be back in a couple of hours, so I'd be back when they got back. I got home about 2 or 3 hours later. My house was built behind my mother's house, and I'm sure all of you saw it. I put it up on Facebook earlier. My son was afraid. He was only 5 years old. He was afraid to be at the house alone. My mother always kept her light on. So he walked down to my mother's. When I pulled in the driveway, I saw my son crying. He was on the step crying, his heart out. He didn't go in the house. He didn't want my mother to see him crying. And it was dark, pitch dark. And I asked him what happened. He said his father left as soon as I left. His father left. My father left after you left. He left him in that house by himself on his birthday at the age of 5 years old. Tell me these are not traumatic events that happen to children. And then to get involved in a first-time relationship where there's racial issues. As I said, my mother became an outcast because she had 2 children by a black man. I was in a 5-year relationship with the Robert Palmer. He was English. And he went home to his parents who lived in Connecticut, and he told them about us. And his parents had a fit. Not only was he involved with a person of color, she was divorced and had a child, so he came home early. And when he told me about it, I decided I'm going to leave because I'm not going to get in between anybody's parents. He wanted to stay connected and not tell them about it. So I ended up leaving him, and I moved to Florida, took my son and moved to Florida. And unfortunately, that's where my son saw me get brutally beaten. There's 2 sides, sometimes 3 sides to every story. And I'm telling this side. A lot of people don't want to tell their stories. But I'm telling this story because my son, since he's been in, and he's been in for 29 years now, has been trying to take educational programs. He's been trying to take work programs. He's been trying to do something. And everything he's tried to do, he's been denied, deprived. He's been kept in solitary confinement so many times because he refuses to double cell. He needs to have a psychologist or a psychiatrist that will go from the inside, from the outside in, an independent evaluation. Because the evaluations done by the penal system, by these psychiatrists or psychologists, are not going to be accurate. If anything, they're going to make it worse. Talk about mass incarceration in the United States. I'm giving you some examples. I'm giving you some examples, people of society, especially you people who claim to be Christians, going to church. I want you to remember one thing. Moses murdered, and Moses was one of the most well-loved people in the Bible. God used him in a big way. King David not only got his loyal soldier impregnated by his wife, but he also had the guy killed. Look at this. Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul, who killed many, many Christians, God used him in a big way. So people, if you're going to judge people that have committed a crime, a fatal crime especially, think about these people that you read about in the Bible all the time, that you pray about in your Catholic, Baptist, Methodist, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, Seventh-day Adventist churches. I've been involved in a lot of churches. I've been a member of all of them. And I remember when this first happened and I was traveling all these countries, I was on the ground, I was on the benches, wherever I was, I had the Bible. And I'm begging and crying out to God, why? Why did this happen? And I'll tell you, God was the only one that got me through it. And I say, God is the only one that's getting my son and I through it. There was a girl, her name was Megan Carlson. And many of you know about her because she was a woman, a young woman, that talked her boyfriend into committing suicide. And she wasn't the only one. There's been others that have been exposed ever since. And there are others that have yet to be exposed. But these people have problems. They have problems if they're going to try to talk their boyfriends into committing suicide. And unfortunately, many of them have committed suicide, but there's some that went just the opposite. They considered suicide, but it turned into homicide. Think about it. Caller 508, do you want to state your name, please?
Hi, Leona. This is Donna. I just want to say, you know, thank you for being courageous and sharing this story. And it truly, it rips my heart out. I'm one who has gotten to know what the carceral system is and the injustices. I've gotten to know many of the incarcerated, and I see, you know, I see the goodness in them, and it just, it tears my heart out. The abuse, the neglect, the torture sometimes that they have to go through, that they're punished again and again and again and again. And I just thank you, Leona, for being that voice for them, because I do think it's going to make a difference. I think we're, you know, going to move the needle, but I have no real big answers as to how to get it solved, how to push, you know, push people who are unwilling to do the right thing. But I'll be darned if I don't, you know, I'll just keep trying.
Donna, you have the answers. It's just that no one's listening. That's the problem. And I want you to let the audience know about your organization, because I'll tell you, Donna Wynette, and I say this all the time, and Franz Dell from Amsterdam, Donna, he loves you. He respects you so much for all the hard work that you're doing. But tell the audience what your organization is about. And because one of the things I want you to talk about, too, is your efforts in trying to get the Department of Mental Health involved.
Oh, thank you, Leona. Well, I have a grandson, and at age 15, his mental health broke down into one of the most serious mental illnesses, one of the three, and the three are schizophrenia, bipolar, and clinical depression, and he has one of those serious mental illnesses. And as time went on and we were fighting for resources, you know, doing everything we knew to do as a family, even, you know, I even gave up some of my work time. Fortunately, I was self-employed, and I could take, you know, some of that time that normally I would work, and I would do everything I could to engage my grandson, keep him busy, keep him happy. But, you know, things broke down. They progressed, his mind, and, you know, lack of proper medication, and he found himself just as involved in at Bridgewater State Hospital. And there I got to see these people who are treated like they're criminals, who have, you know, almost always they've committed these, you know, what legally is termed as a crime, but they've committed these acts or alleged acts, and under the strains of psychosis, where they don't really understand, you know, what's real, what reality is, and what isn't reality, and so they find themselves just as involved. And I vowed my grandson will never be without family, so I spent quite a time. I do spend quite a time, quite a bit of time, visiting him, and I got to meet family after family after family, and patient. I call them patients. At one point they were inmates, and now they're person served, according to Bridgewater State Hospital, but they don't serve them very well, so I refer to them as patients. And I saw these, you know, beautiful human beings who have different talents. Some are plumbers, and some are book lovers, and some are gentle, and they're kind, and they're generous, and they're supportive of one another, and they're still broken in some ways with their mental illness, but they're so worthy as human beings. And I saw how they would fall through the cracks, and Bridgewater would work to, their goal is to make them competent to stand trial. And then they're imprisoned with mental illness because they're competent and understand basics doesn't mean they're not mentally ill. And to place them in prisons and jails, to me, is just so immoral. And so I began to advocate for a continuum of care for these individuals who are forensically involved. And as I began to advocate year after year after year, I saw the whole picture of the whole carceral system. And even the people there who are not, you know, who do not have serious mental illness, the fact that they're punished again and again and again and denied health care and denied human respect and dignity, I just began to fight harder and harder and harder, and trying to make my voice bigger and louder and doing whatever I can, you know, to work with legislators and to do what I can to improve at the lives and the second chances of persons who have become justice involved. And the crazy thing is, Leona, there's so many out there in the system that are corrupt themselves. They steal overtime. You know, I'm talking about law enforcement and even judges. You know, they're not always fair, they're not always just, and then they're judging these people and punishing them. So, I just have a passion to see mercy and kindness, compassion, justice, restorative efforts, restitution, recovery, rehabilitation, all those good things going forward.
You know, I just heard recently learned, even with the former chief of police in Massachusetts, I'm sure you saw that, not only him, but there's other law enforcement police, there's other police officers that are going to be also charged with all the time that they were putting in and not working. There's hundreds of thousands, what was his name, Evans? Former police chief Evans, and I think they mentioned six others, but these are the things. But, you know, Donna, when my son first went in, they shipped him to Pennsylvania, alleging that there was a threat made on his life. They used this for years, and about 6 months ago, the very person they claimed had my son's name on his enemies list had written me a letter, and he said he didn't even know my son. He said he doesn't know how they happened to put my son's name on his enemies list. And my son wrote a letter to the same effect, and I sent it to the Department of Corrections investigative team and to get it resolved. After all these years, they have prevented my son from being near any family support, any support whatsoever. After they shipped him to Pennsylvania, they assigned a public defender to do his appeal. He wasn't even at his own appeal. He never got a chance to be at his own appeal. Throughout the years, after he got sent to Pennsylvania, years later, we were doing national work, and I heard that there were these men that were being kept in the hole, and they were being abused badly. And I reached out, and I'll tell you, somebody from Massachusetts in the caucus, she gave me the names of these senators and people in Pennsylvania to contact, and I also contacted ACLU. I wrote, emailed Leanna Washington over and over again, nothing. I contacted the ACLU, nothing happened. Then one of them ended up allegedly killing himself. So again, I emailed her, I contacted ACLU, I contacted other legislative members, nothing happened. Second one ended up dying. This is all in 3-month period, all in the same prison. The next one died. Again, I contacted her, I contacted ACLU. It wasn't until the third one died. And she went before the media and she said, had she known, she would have called for an independent investigation. And then she started talking about the bodies, how they cremated the bodies. And I got really upset then because none of the bodies were cremated. So I emailed her and I told her, you need to talk with the parents. You need to talk with the family of these prisoners because the bodies were not cremated. To this day, I never heard from her, but we had to put on a rally at the Capitol Rotunda in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I had to go out there then, too. I had to fill out all this paperwork, which I still have copies of it, to get approval to have this rally at the Capitol Rotunda. There was very little I could do because I didn't want to have my name out there in the media or anything because I had a loved one. So after it was over, I went over, her spokesperson was there, and I said to her, what does Leanna Washington have against me? She said, who are you? And I told her my name. She said, oh, you're the one that called the senator a liar. I said, I would never call a senator a liar. I would never disrespect a legislative member. But she needed to get the facts, and I was trying to keep her from embarrassing herself. Do you know, Donna, her spokesperson came over to me. She put her arms around me, and she thanked me. To this day, I have not heard from Leanna Washington, but her own spokesperson put her arms around me and thanked me. What happened is the person from Massachusetts legislative members, she all of a sudden turned against me. She blocked me out completely. And I believe it's because Leanna Washington got in touch with her about this woman from Massachusetts that was out there. And if that were the case, this woman I admired so much in Massachusetts just completely turned my admiration against her. Because I no longer thought of her as a leader, but a follower. And as you know, Donna, even in my organization with my volunteers, I always reiterate the fact that I want these volunteers to learn something. I want them to learn how to be leaders and not followers. Because we have so many people in this country, especially Massachusetts, so many people that are turning against advocates because other advocates have a problem with them. Or they're turning against advocates, or they're turning against somebody because somebody that they're connected with or they're in cliques with or whatever don't like them. Those are not leaders to me. Those are followers. Because a leader, there was an advocate, Melissa Emmeling. She's an advocate in Florida. She had a problem with another advocate. She wanted me, and I had given her time on the show to have her own show. And she had invited this girl on, and then I guess they were both working on the same case. And she got, from what I understand, she got jealous of the other girl because the other girl was doing more and getting acknowledged. So she said to me, I blocked her. I don't want her on the show, on my show. I don't. And I said, that's between you. But I said, one thing, Melissa, I said, if you're going to be an advocate and she's an advocate, you're going to have differences. None of us have the same thoughts all the time. We have to agree to disagree. So she got mad at me, Melissa got mad at me, and I had to end up blocking her and stopping her from using my show. Because I'm not going to, and I told her, I don't get involved in conflicts with others. We're all advocates. We're all working for the same cause. And if we're going to start turning against one another because somebody in the network is having a problem with somebody else, that's between them, not me. But we have members of society that think on those same lines. They take sides without knowing all the facts. And this is why I felt I had to bring this forward. I didn't want to, and I'm still feeling reluctant to putting everything out there that I know, but I want the truth to come out. And like I said, this Freddie Rivers, a detective in Massachusetts, was a detective on Cape Cod. I think he's retired now. He lied. Casey Sherman, an author who went to school with my son, they played football together at the school, but they never hung out together. And for him to say they double dated, when they know, when he knows it came out in court, my son had not dated until he was in his third year of college. And that was because he was always feeling insecure, low self-esteem because of a brother-in-law. And I'm going to tell you, Henry Owens asked me at the end of the court who that brother-in-law was. And I told him his name is Buenaventura Rivera. They call him Peter Rivera. And that man violated my son. And to think that everybody's going to still talk to this man and accept this man while my son's serving a life without parole in prison. And unfortunately, the others that he violated, they want to go on with their lives. They don't want to keep thinking of it. And my own niece told me she wants to forget about it. She wants to go on with her life. These are the things that happen. The innocent continue to suffer and not have to, the guilty not have to pay a penny or stay a day in prison, while others affected by their traumas have lost their lives because of biased people, people that judge, people that don't know what's going on but decide it's there. And I'll tell you another thing is I had a brother, the one that walked out when my father died. His family may not want to believe it, but when I came back from overseas, the person renting my house told me that the person I put in charge of everything had exhausted all my funds, all my assets, and I didn't believe it until I came back, and I eventually found out. So sometimes we're going through enough traumas without having our own family and friends turn against us, but this is what happened.
Yeah.
Audience, if anyone wants to call in, ask questions, make statements, whatever the case may be, feel free to call in. The number is 657-383-1630. Again, it's 657-383-1630. You know, Donna, I want to say something else, too. My son, since he's been in, he's not been a problem, but he has all kinds of disciplinary reports for refusing to double cell. I had contacted three of the representatives, Liz Miranda, Senator Miranda, Senator Eldridge, Ayanna Pressley's office, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. You know, Senator Eldridge, I admire him. He wrote a letter. He wrote a letter to the DOC because they were meeting on some other things, and he mentioned my son's name and another prisoner's name as needing the medical attention. And unfortunately, they didn't do anything about it, but he at least made that effort. The others, they started to help. But when they were getting nowhere with the DOC, rather than to challenge the DOC, they completely ignored my son and myself since then. And it's unfortunate because the very people that got into politics, that got in, the governor, My not only my son, but other prisoners told me exactly who to vote for because I don't vote. I don't vote for anybody in government because none of them have done anything to help. So, but I did. I voted for all the five people that they wanted me to vote for. One of them was Governor Healey, and I admire her. She's doing an awesome job, and I hope she continues to do that job she's doing. Adriana Campbell.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we can connect with her. I did end up, Leona, applying for the Executive Office of Public Safety.
All right.
The EO, what is it, EOPSS. There's a position open for a committee to work toward, you know, some carceral improvements and reentry services. So I will hear at the end of March 31st. So I'm doing every which way I can think of to, you know, not, it's not an agenda. It's how do I get to where I need to get to be heard and to get the help that we need. So one of the things I failed to mention when you asked me you know, about my organization, I failed to say the name of it, which is the Families and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness, and then we advocate for those who, you know, are justice involved. So it's FEMI, Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness. And FEMI has been really working hard because it began with family members who had or still have loved ones at Bridgewater State Hospital. And that's just, you know, in a way, it's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, we see the immediate change that's needed there, and we've been working very hard to advance Senator Balzer's bill, which is House Bill 2985, and that is to place Bridgewater State Hospital away from, out of the Department of Corrections, you know, a penal environment for sick people, and into the Department of Mental Health. And right now it has advanced to the Committee on Healthcare Financing, and the person, one of the persons in charge is one of the legislators we've been working with, who is very compassionate. She understands the issues. She, you know, she's very aware because we have worked with her. So, you know, very hopeful that this can take place. The Disability Law Center does a biannual report on Bridgewater State Hospital and Old Colony Correctional Center, where there is a population of people with mental illness, and, you know, there it's an out-and-out prison. And, you know, there's been reports. There was a report from NCI Norfolk, and it told about a correction officer that died in the parking lot from a drug overdose. But worse, it had correction officers on video in the prison sniffing, you know, cocaine and sexually abusing some of the inmates, which is just crazy. And, you know, these are supposed to be people of the law. But this latest report, now my grandson has been widely neglected, and I have documented every inch of the way. I'm working with stakeholders. I'm working, you know, with his attorney. And he has recurring cysts. He's had them, and they're very painful, hanging from his underarms, his stomach. There was a huge one on his neck, you know. So we and the rest of my family have really taken action now, because it's just getting worse and worse, his medical condition. He's about to be, you know, without any teeth because they've allowed his teeth to rot. So he's that person. He's that person that the reports are talking about, that the Senator Warren and Senator Markey, you know, they're talking about the lack of dental care. And now, I don't know if you've seen, Leona, but there's article after article after article, and Channel 5 did a news story. So this latest DLC report, they cite violence. They continue these violent, illegal chemical restraints. So I think with the bill advancing, I think we have a pretty good chance, you know, of finally getting some progress and getting the help we need. So, you know, I'm working closely with Representative Balzer. She is retiring in December. So, you know, we shall see what happens after that. But it looks good so far.
The commission is retiring the end of this month.
Yes. And, you know, the DOJ report cited all of the ills that she's allowed to happen with, if you remember, with solitary confinement, and different reports, that Norfolk report that I talked of, and, you know, all kinds of different reports have not been favorable to her. So I think she chose to, you know, they're calling it retire, but I think it's because of all the pressure and all the light that's been shown upon all the ills in this system. And they're doing a national search So I'm hoping, you know, we get somebody like a Franz Dow or a super, we'd like to see Superintendent David Tuttle or Lou Evangelides, Sheriff Evangelides. We, you know, we've been working with the individual jails as much as possible through the years, and we, you know, we kind of understand who the best ones are. So, you know, we'd like to see that, but I think the national search is good.
Yeah.
But, I haven't really, you know, you say Governor Healey is good, and because we haven't had much access or even much news, can you give me a few updates on what she's doing? And
actually, the governor said the other day about the releases, the thousands of prisoners being released. Marijuana was legalized, I guess, within the last couple of years. They finally legalized marijuana, right?
Right.
Okay. The governor recently announced, it was in the news, that she's releasing thousands of prisoners in Massachusetts who are incarcerated on marijuana, that are serving sentences for marijuana usage.
Good.
Thousands.
Good.
Another thing is, there is a committee of lawyers that are going to be working. I don't know. I think they're starting with 18 to 20 prisoners who are serving. They're serving long sentences to life, and these people are working with them on clemency. And the thing is, the head person of the committee is that Patricia DeJunis. Now, Patricia DeJunis at one time, and this is why I say connections, lawyers, talking to lawyers, she was very sympathetic of the situation even my son was in. And then maybe a week or so later, it was totally opposite. So I spoke to another attorney, and the attorney said to me maybe she was having a bad day. So when I tried to call, they told me to call her again. So when I tried to call her again, Donna, it was like talking to somebody that was really mentally ill. She was going, blah, 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 blah. The whole time I was trying to talk, I finally had to hang up because she wouldn't stop.
Well,
so that was letting me know that she didn't want nothing to do with my son or myself. She didn't even want to talk to me. But this is why I say, when people have connections and the connections are with lawyers, this is what happens. I could not believe it. I've never had any professional person acting like that in my lifetime.
Wow.
And the woman, and I don't want to mention the female lawyer that told me to try it again, but that female lawyer, she is really good. She's a beautiful person. She's helping somebody, some other prisoners, I guess, with their clemency or whatever. But this lawyer, I wish there were more like her. We have 605. You want to state your name, please? 605? Okay, is somebody either listening? It looks like it might be a South Dakota number, probably Chinupa, but if he's talking at all, we're not hearing him. But these are the things that I say, though. These things need to be resolved, because if this is happening with my own loved one, being denied every corner he goes to, being denied every service he's requesting, I know there's more out there that are going through the same thing, and that's what's
sad
about.
Have heard that with other individuals too, and even model, you know, people trying so hard in this really difficult environment, you know, in an almost gotcha. They're trying to be model inmates, and they have, you know, they're just given so many roadblock after roadblock after roadblock.
This is
and some of these prisons don't institute the programs they could or should, or it's just pretty tough.
Anyone can tell you when before my son committed this first and only offense, he had no time for doing anything but work, school, and gym. He was very, very healthy. He was now to know that, you know, there's a lot of things he can't do anymore. But the problem is, all he's ever wanted, and the senators, the legislative members, they can tell you, all he's ever asked for And after the damage done to his shoulder and his knee, a doctor at Lemuel Shattuck Hospital recommended or ordered that he be allowed to purchase supportive footwear because the prison shoes are contributing to the pain, to the problem. And this is where the legislative members were trying to advocate for him to be able to purchase the supportive footwear. Then the prison official, Mitchell, James Mitchell, approves it. And then after the approval, the next day or two or three days later, he writes, he says, you must have misunderstood, he said, because the doctor there was going to give him some kind of profit, I guess they call it profit shoes, and they were going to cut a hole in the toe to alleviate the pain. So rather than to have him, allow him to make a one-time purchase, as the doctor had ordered at Lemuel Shattuck, they wanted him to wear a pair of shoes, prison shoes, and they were going to cut a hole in it so that it would relieve the pain. It didn't make sense. So the legislative members were advocating for that, but I guess the Department of Corrections, their union is so powerful that even our own legislative members are afraid to challenge them. And so what did they do? They just backed away from it all completely.
Yeah.
And that's sad. But as I said before, these prisoners, they had me vote for these very people. And as they say, the governor, she's doing a good deed. She made it so that they can have free phone calls and free emails, free virtual visits, and so that they could, the thousands that they're going to be releasing that are in for marijuana usage, she's doing a good job. Now, the Attorney General's office, I contacted the Attorney General's office. I spoke to an intake worker there for quite a while. She was very nice. But then after that, the next time I contacted her because nothing had been done, and they completely would not respond to me. They would not return my calls or anything. And Liz Maddox is no longer with PLS, Prison Legal Services. She's now, I guess, the director of the unit, their civil rights unit. So I don't know what's going on with all that, but back to square one and trying to get anybody to listen or to understand what's going on. But as I started to say, My son has only asked for those three things: to be allowed to take programs, participate in educational programs or work programs, and to be able to have his single cell status, which is very important, especially to prisoners who are having problems in the area of being, you know, having to double cell. So because of him having this problem, he has remained or chosen to remain at Sousa Baranowski, because this is the only way he can keep his single cell status. But again, being in a maximum secure prison for that reason shouldn't be. Then they were going to transfer him to Norfolk. They were going to transfer him to Norfolk, and we were both thrilled because, Donna, my eyesight is going. My doctor said I'm pre-diabetic now, so my eyesight is deteriorating. Norfolk would have been just a few towns over from me. I would have been able to visit him more. And so they were going to send him to Norfolk. The next day they sent him, they denied it because they said because of that prisoner that was supposed to have had him on his enemies list. And that's why we requested from that prisoner a letter to the effect that they don't know one another. And that prisoner wrote it. He couldn't even understand why they put it on. But once we got that resolved, then they sent him to Shirley Medium. Why couldn't they have just sent him to Norfolk as they planned to do before? And this has been the games that they've been playing all along.
Is he in Shirley now? Is that where he is now?
He's at Shirley now, but because he's refused to double cell, they've had him in restrictive. He said they'll probably keep him there for a few months. He said he won't be able to contact me. So he told me that I probably won't hear from him for a few months. So this is the way it is, and this is the games they've been playing with him all throughout. That's all. This has been a role model prisoner. He has not had any problems with other prisoners, and all he's asked for is to be single-celled like he has been all these years, but because he's been in single-cell all these years, he's had to fight his way to get these single-cell status. So when they put him in a cell with somebody, he goes off. He can't cope. He can't deal with it. This whole thing, this PTSD childhood trauma, it comes right back up again.
Yes,
and they
I
know
do
this.
Understand that.
They know this, and this is what really is so frustrating, because they know it and they provoke it. They keep doing it because they know that this is preventing him from adjusting.
it's so hard to understand the absolute cruelty of it all. You know, a couple of things. There was one couple that was just got their first visit since November. They've been fighting to visit their loved one who's severely mentally ill at Bridgewater State Hospital. They had to get their legislator involved. And then, you know, I mentioned my grandson having these recurring cysts and boils. And I read in this report, I don't think it's my grandson,
Donna,
according
Donna,
to the report,
Donna,
but I'm going to be
Donna,
investigating it.
Donna, I hate to interrupt you, but believe it or not, the one we're talking about is on the phone now.
And oh, good.
Yeah, we are talking about your situation, Tony, and we're talking about everything that's been going on, even with the enemies listing all that and the lack of transferring and them putting you in solitary all these times because you didn't want to be double cell. We're talking about we're going on live national, and right now Donna Wynette is on with us, and she was just talking about it. Say hello, Donna.
Hi, Tony. I adore your mother. I love her very much. She's an amazing woman, and I know you're an amazing young man, maybe not quite so young anymore, but, you know, my heart is with you. My heart is with, you know, this difficult situation that you're enduring, and I'm a person who prays for all of you guys and does my best to use my little voice against a big system to try to get some good changes. And, you know, please know that there are people out here who value you as a human being. We don't dehumanize you. We know your worth. You know, we understand your worth as a human being, and we really care. And, you know, we might not have the power to change, but we're trying. We're never going to give up. And, you know, there are people, so please be assured there's people who really care and support you guys, and I'm one of them.
Can you hear her okay, Tony?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
I want to tell you right now, people are listening in, family members and friends, and also the audience is listening in, so they know what's going on with this whole situation. And so if you want to say something, Tony, please do, because this is an opportunity to finally get it out.
Yeah, don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. I've been in, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been incarcerated for 28 years. This is nothing. This is how America is. I understand that, and I know that no help is coming, and I don't need help. I have myself, and that's all that matters, so I'm fine.
Well, you have God on your side too, Tony.
No, that's fine, but everyone has to stop worrying. You know, take care of your own lives. I'm fine. I've been dealing with these creatures for quite some time, and I'll be fine. That's all.
You know what? I'll tell you, Donna, he has, like I said, with the lawyer, the lawyer's not wanting to help, and everything he's gone through, he's been fighting for him by himself. And, you know, we were just talking about that, Tony, and the audience is listening, and it's live, so this is a time to get it all out. And I want people to know the real John Anthony. I want them to know the real Tony, because people, like I say, stereotype incarcerated individuals, and they try to make it look bad and the worst. But Donna, being an advocate for family and friends for the individuals with mental illnesses, she was just talking about the things that they do in the prisons, and a lot of times it's the employees themselves that are the ones that are the ones that are doing the worst crime. But I wanted you to just let them know what you've been trying to do since you've been inside, what you've been trying to do throughout these years. Please tell them.
No, I've been trying to further my education, but they've denied that. But other than that, listen, everyone out there, life is too short. Enjoy your life. Don't worry about me in prison. I'm fine. You guys worry about yourself. Take care of yourself. And I've been doing this quite some time. I know no help's coming. And that's part of being in prison. I understand how America is. This is America. And there's no compassion shown to some. But that's how it is, and I'll be fine no matter what.
Tony, can you tell them about your shoulder and your knee, too? I talked about Adriana Carrillo, and Donna, she already saw that WellPath and all the things that they've been doing with medical and how they've been messing up. Can you talk about your shoulder and your knee?
Well, just go to WGBH Greater Boston. That's a television program. They had a half-hour special about how Adriana Carrillo has maimed people and destroy people's lives. She's done that to me, and like I said, there's nothing I can do. That's how America is. Everyone should be proud of this country because this country doesn't really care about certain individuals, and that's how it is. I understand exactly what I'm going to get, and I understand exactly what this country is about. So don't worry about me. You guys take care of yourselves. I'm fine.
And Donna's been also in trying to help to find a way to get an independent psychiatrist to go in and diagnose you, evaluate you for the PTSD. So
regardless of what any psychiatrist are diagnosing me with, they're going to treat me how they treat me. That's how America is. You guys don't understand how it is in prison walls, behind prison walls. That's just how it is. They're going to do whatever they want to do, and that's just how it is. They did the same thing, and I know people may think that Auschwitz, you couldn't make a comparison. In Auschwitz, there were bodies that were produced, but here they destroy the mind. They don't destroy the body, they destroy the mind. And in some cases, they destroy the body also. But our country is participating in the same sort of concentration camps that they had in 20th century Europe. So nothing surprises me. I'll be fine. You guys take care of yourselves and don't ever forget what the country's about.
Well, we're not going to give up on you. We're not going to give up on you or others because we know that this is a problem that needs to be resolved, and we're going to be continuing to work on it. Miranda sent an email, and she said that the person she spoke with at the DOC said Mr. Dias was seen by the mental health provider while housed at Sousa Baranowski. He was transferred to MCI Shirley on 313, where he was also seen by mental health. Since being transferred, he has been seen by mental health two additional times. Please be assured that the provider is aware of Mr. Dias' concerns and are treating them in accordance with their clinical guidelines. But you know what? What we're trying to get is
they just lied to you guys because when they saw me at Sousa Baranowski, all they said was, someone's going to see you soon. And nobody ever saw me. That was what seeing me was. They said, someone's going to see me soon. And nobody saw me. And then when I came here, what did they do? Hey, do you want some puzzles? That's all. They didn't see me. They didn't evaluate me. All they said was, hey, how you doing? You want some puzzles? Okay, hey, it must be rough, you know, being in there. So they don't treat people. Again, they're going to lie to you guys, and there's nothing you guys can do, I can do, but that's just America. That's how this country is. Our state officials lie to us, and we take it.
Jeez. What do you think about that, Donna?
It breaks my heart, honestly, because I don't think anyone should ever be dehumanized. And I think, you know, the separation of families, you know, making visitations difficult, and it dehumanizes a person's personal roots, separates them from the people who love them, and by withholding proper health care, it's just unethical, and it's sickening.
But that's what this country was founded on, dehumanizing people. Look at the First Nations that came here, that were here before us. They helped us survive that first winter. They fed us. They showed us how to survive. And what did we do? We committed mass murder against them and took their land. That's what this country is founded on, dehumanizing people. And it's continued to this day. All they want you to do is everyone shut up, pay your tax money so we can give your tax money to Israel so they can kill Palestinians. And, hey, we'll be nice. We'll give the Palestinians food while they get murdered by Israel. But everyone shut up and let us do what we're going to do. That's how this country is. Everyone should be very proud of this country. That's how this country is. This is what we say, where America is an exceptionalism, American exceptionalism. That's what it is. Shut up and let us humanize you. But hey, I'm fine. Don't worry about me.
Well, we're going to have, a virtual conference, and a lot of people are going to be coming, but Gary, the criminal defense attorney in Texas had written me and wanted to know what this thing was going to be about. So I explained to him what we're going to be doing on the radio show, and I hope everybody will be listening in because we're going to be on April 2nd at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We're going to be interviewing, having a show with people from all over London and Belgium and the Netherlands and the United States as well, we're going to be talking about a virtual conference or convention between all parties, and we're going to be asking the legislative members, and they're going to get a copy of all of this, the legislative members to also participate. But Donna, I wanted to let you know when Gary and Franz responded, when I explained to Gary, because he was not too sure about what it meant, and I explained it, and Franz wrote back and he said, "Good explanation, Donna." He wanted me to know, but he apparently had you on the mind. So the work you're doing with them in your organization, apparently it's working. But Franz said, "A good explanation. Thank you. I'm in." He said, "I'm in. When I believe awareness is promoted and people get inspired to make a difference within their own circle of influence, the fact that different disciplines like experienced experts are involved makes talking about planning a periodic exchange interesting. People like you, Gary, and me could be experts or invite people from our network to join." So, and he said, "I assume Leona and people around her will be organizers." So what we're trying to do is get the government in the states, and I'm going to be sending this to Maura Healey as well and some of the other politicians to see if they will be on this virtual meeting when we do have it. And there's going to be, like I say, the consultant from North Carolina. Her name is Kimberly McTerrion. She's the founder of Save Our Sons. And also Nina Champion, who is a consultant and a criminal justice advocate out of London. Then, of course, Franz Del from Amsterdam and some of the others from Belgium and from other countries out that way. But hopefully we're going to be seeing some progress in Tony, I just want you to know that what's going to happen from here on in is we're going to be exposing and we're going to be bringing these stories out. So what you're going through right now, you're not going to be going through it alone. And you can tell the audience, you can tell us all, you know, to just go on and forget about you. But we're not going to forget about you. You are one of God's children, and God knows the truth. And I want everybody to know the real John Anthony Dias, because a lot of people have been assuming or they've been fed false statements. I also mentioned Freddie Rivers and what he was about. Tony, can you let the audience know, did you know Freddie Rivers prior to him going down there to bring you back?
Never met the man before.
And Freddie Rivers, a detective no longer with the police force, but was saying that he knew Tony, he knew my son, and that's why he was able to travel all over the country, all over the world. Even when I had left the country, he was able to travel and have his free vacation. Now, Casey Sherman, as I said before, Casey went to school with my son, but Tony, did you and Casey ever hang around outside of school?
No.
And Casey said in the news article, the Cape Cod Times, that he and my son double dated, and all of the family and friends that know my son know that he did not. When did you start dating, Tony?
No, I wasn't until college, but you're focusing on a bunch of people that lie. I don't care about the lies are in the past. There's nothing we can do about those lies now. So just please, just forget about those clowns. It's all a bunch of lies. It doesn't even bother me because it's been so many years ago. Let them continue to lie. But just you guys go on with your lives and enjoy yourselves and stop worrying about those clowns. That's how the world is. It's a bunch of clowns in the world.
But you know, Tony, you look at our country, America, and it saddens me, but within that country, there are people who genuinely, genuinely care, and they value you, they value the people who are incarcerated, they understand that their worth. I say it's, you guys are God's property, and how dare the people, you know, if you believe in God, they're abusing God's property. You know, I wouldn't want to face God after doing that. But, you know, there are those of us, and it's just embedded within our hearts. So, you know, if you tell me, go ahead with your life, and, you know, I will enjoy parts of my life, but I will not forget this population, because you're part of us. And you deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. And for that, I'm going to continue to fight. And like your mom, I'm up there. You know, I'm of retirement age. But thank God I have the energy, you know, and I can take the time and I can do this work because I care and I have compassion. And that compassion goes towards you and for all of those of your brothers, you know, your sisters, and the people who are being dehumanized or abused and neglected. We can't forget about you. We can't, because you are part of us. You're part of, you know, you're part of our humanity. You're part of us. Every life has value.
So, see, Tony, you're not alone.
I appreciate that, but those voices are few and far between, unfortunately. But I appreciate the effort and the thoughts. I appreciate that.
You know, Donna has been, actually, she's been trying to get the Department of Mental Health involved. She's even went, her committee, they even try to meet with Mass General Hospital, trying to get independent providers to go in. Because everybody knows that WellPath has been sued over 1,000 times. You know, everybody knows about the medical providers that are being used by the Department of Corrections in Massachusetts and other states, too.
Well, with the mental health providers within Susan Baranowski and here at MCI Shirley, all the clinicians, there's not one African-American clinician, be it Susan Baranowski or at MCI Shirley.
But the,
and yet there's hundreds that African-American psychology students that graduate from universities every year, but yet WellPath does not employ one single one within two facilities.
Is it that they don't employ them, or they don't, these people are not trying to get employed?
Well, again, who doesn't want a job out of college? You always hear about students, you know, trying to get employment and finding difficulty getting employment out of college. But yet, the WellPath, they'll employ African-American nurses. But again, the nurses just hand out psychiatric medications to people. And a trained monkey could do that. But yet, when it deals with trying to rebuild someone's self-esteem and heal their mental health issues, there's not one African-American clinician. So that just shows you they don't care about that. They don't care about actually healing people and getting someone from someone's own culture that understands about racism and the effects of it. So that just shows you who you're dealing with. Is WellPath, they don't have not one African-American clinician within two facilities. Not one. And if you look at all the
countries, somehow to speak to them, Tony. I've been doing as much public speaking as I can, and one of the avenues is your mom, but I also speak to groups. And I recently, not too long ago, I spoke to a group that had quite a few psychiatric nurses, and two of them especially came to me week after week after week and said, Donna, you know, I cared about my clients before hearing you speak, but afterwards, I really care. And another one said, I've really thought about what you've said. And, you know, so something that I shared, you know, because I know the system and I've met inmates, you know, and able to, you know, thank God I was able to articulate your pain, your suffering, and it's made them, you know, according to these two women, it's made them more compassionate than they were. So if there were a way that we could gather these African-American women, clinicians, you know, and just speak to them, you know, just touch their heartstrings and, you know, give them the hard facts about the ills and the sufferings that, you know, inmates have to go through. And I see your steely reserve, you know, and I applaud you for that. You know, it's thank God you can take that attitude, Tony, and say, you know, I can take care of myself. You know, I wish you didn't have to have that attitude, but I admire that you're rising within a very difficult situation. But I think education, you know, you're denied a lot of education, but some of these psychiatric nurses of African American, you know, descent, if we could speak with them and talk with them, I'd be happy to do it. And, you know, maybe we could get them to move in the right direction.
No, that's fine. You can talk to them and you can educate them, but WellPath's not going to hire them because from what I've seen, and I hate to say it, but WellPath seems racist in that area. of the punishment units here, you'll see of 40 prisoners, you'll see maybe four are white. And in the privilege units, you'll see 64 prisoners and 32 are white. So numbers don't lie. I've tried to tell this to prison legal services and some of their representatives also. Numbers don't lie. And that's just how, unfortunately, and I don't like to use the term racism lightly, but this is a very, very racist prison system and very racist healthcare provider with WellPass.
I'm really, really grateful that you're telling me this because your mom has spoken with one of my very good friends and fellow advocates, and he actually has just built a brand new advocacy group called Mental Illness Hurts. And his name is Harry McHugh, and he has a loved one, within Bridgewater State Hospital, which is a prison, and he deeply, deeply, deeply digs and digs and digs. He has put together a document on the history of WellPath, and now I'm going to have him. He's an amazing researcher. I don't know how he finds out salaries. He finds out everything, histories and resumes. And so I'm going to ask him to look into this and do some expose on it. Thank you for informing me of this because
his time ran out, Donna. His time ran out, but I'm glad you mentioned that. And I want to say one thing, too. You know, back then when he was going through that severe depression, there was a friend of the family. Her name is Lori. And Lori Penberthy. And Lori saw my son's depression, and she spoke in court. But the district attorney tried to make it seem as though, oh, she was just saying that because she was a friend of the family. You know, I actually, at one time, Lori was my client. But that was years ago when she was much younger. But you know what? That depression, it affected her so much that Lori, she lives in Ohio, but Lori ended up becoming a psychiatric nurse for years. And she was working in one of the prisons in Ohio as a psychiatric nurse. But when somebody is that affected, sees something like that so severe, and they later become a psychiatric nurse as a result, you know that it had to have been pretty bad.
That's true. I'm really glad Tony pointed out that fact about the psychiatric nurses because Harry, he is the most amazing, deepest researcher. And, you know, that's something that should be addressed because, you know, as your son pointed out, you know, the percentages of those who are incarcerated, you know, they should at least have someone who could connect with them, you know, on a cultural basis and understand some of the cultural experiences, you know, negative and, you know, positive, but those negative experiences that can, you know, relate to them and help them through their trauma.
You know what? I agree with what my son was saying, but at the same time, I'm wondering, are these nurses, are they actually trying to apply for jobs? Are they trying to, you know, there was a time on Cape Cod years ago when they used to bus people in from New Bedford or Fall River to do work on Cape Cod because a lot of the people on Cape Cod didn't want to do the work. And yet, because they were busing people in from New Bedford and Fall River, a lot of the people were getting upset because outsiders were taking the jobs. So this is why I say sometimes it has to be worked on both sides. You know, they have to make an effort, and if they don't get the jobs, then complain about it. You know, do something about it. But you have to try. I used to tell my brother, my youngest brother, he passed away a few years ago from a massive heart attack, but I used to tell my brother Johnny, because he used to always seem to fail in everything he tried to do. And I said, sometimes you have to reach for the heavens, reach for as high as you can go. And you may not get all the way. You may only get halfway there, but at least you're getting further than you would have if you didn't do anything. So,
right. True.
And this is why I say sometimes if we want something bad enough, we're gonna fight for it. And look at you and I, and I'm sure so many other advocates out there. We've been fighting for years to try to see some changes in the penal system, and it's going to happen. It depends on who the person is. Like I say, with Maura Healey, this woman has done more than Charlie Baker did the whole 4 years or whatever, how many years he was in. She's done more in the prison system in the short time she's been in, and not only the prison system, but she's advocating for the women as well. She's advocating for a lot of these things that are going on. So it depends on the soul. It depends on the heart. Like they say, circumcision of the heart. This is why I say eventually I believe Maura Healey will do a lot more than she's doing. And you and I have to keep doing what we're doing. And what you're doing is even more important, Donna, because you're getting to the heart of the souls of all these people. You're actually calling. You're actually meeting with them. And so that's why I say what you're doing. Volunteer Match, and I don't know if I told you this before, but not only for families and friends, for individuals with mental illnesses, but other organizations that are advocating for prisoners or advocating for mental health issues, to go on Volunteer Match and register your organization with them and then start posting for these volunteers. And you can post for volunteer psychiatric nurses or volunteer psychologists or whatever. There's a lot of retired psychologists and psychiatrists that are looking to do something, and they would do it on a voluntary basis.
Yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it? That's a good point. It's a very good point.
But I had somebody one time contact me, and they were at the time. I didn't need that particular, but I can't remember. But it was somebody that was retired, and he wanted to do some volunteer work with an organization that was, I forgot what it was about. It's been so long. But some of them are just looking to do something like this, you know, voluntarily, just to keep busy.
Yeah. Especially if they have an interest and some expertise in the field.
If they're retired psychologists or psychologists, a lot of them would be. And with what you're talking about with Bridgewater being under the auspice of Department of Mental Health, that is exactly what should be taking place.
You know what's interesting? What's interesting, Leona, my husband's primary care doctor, who's actually the chief of staff at St. Vincent Hospital and a really good man, and he's very interested in, you know, the work we're doing in the field of mental illness. And he's involved with the Psychiatric Association, and we asked to meet with them, and he said, well, they're, you know, many of them are about to retire.
And that's what you need.
So, you know, maybe I can re-ask him. Bob goes to see him tomorrow and see if he can connect us with some of these people.
Exactly.
And, you know, maybe they can work with us toward those legislative needs and, you know, any other way that we could have use of them and educate, you know, and push back at WellPath and some of these attorneys. But I thought it was very generous of your son to not, you know, very unselfish. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want us to not enjoy our lives, and he's kind of resigned, you know, to this is the way it is, and, you know, I'm going to be okay. He's reassuring us. We're not going to forget about him.
Like I say, he's been fighting for himself for years, you know, without a father. And there were so many things that he was going through that he wouldn't tell me because he didn't want, even now, he didn't want to hurt me, or he didn't want me to know about a lot of things that were happening. My son was very protective of me, and I think it happened after the time I was in Florida when I got, you know, that brutal beating. And ever since then, he was protected. But I tell people, if they think that I'm godly or I'm good, they haven't met, I'm the one that should be in prison. If that's the case, I'm the one that should be behind, he has more patience than I do. And he's gone through so much, and he's been able to be resilient through it all until that one last time.
I could hear that, you know, and I could hear that steely resolve, you know, and the fact that he's saying to us, go live your life, enjoy it, I thought it was a very unselfish sentiment.
Yeah.
You know, rather than feel so sorry for himself at the deprivations of where he's at, you know, he's encouraging us to, you know, at least have the joy that we can have. It was very sweet.
You know, the thing is, sweetness, he's been in all these years. You know what? To this day, my son would not take money from me. He's been indigent. All his mail, if he was to get money now, they would be deducting all the money for the postage and everything, because his postage, everything is in the thousands. And it's because he spent most of these years trying to file civil suits for being deprived of everything. So the things that he has gone through and not having a lawyer, he's had to try to fight for himself. I remember several years ago when he filed a lawsuit against the prison because they were depriving, they weren't even responding to his grievances. And he filed a civil suit. And what happened is several months into the suit, the prison officials put him in solitary confinement. They filed a motion to have his case dismissed. And once his case was dismissed, they released him after that. He was at that point in time, he was going to appeal the court's decision when the coronavirus came in. And what they did at that point in time, they took his law books and they gave his law books to the prison library. They put him on a restrictive block. And this is where he was all those years until recently. And this is where the legislative members, this is where I had contacted Senator Eldridge. And he was trying to advocate. So he called the prison, and they told Senator Eldridge he was not on a restrictive block. He was in general population. And Senator Eldridge asked him, if that's the case, why did they take his law books? And the prison official that Senator Eldridge spoke with said he would check into it, and that was the end of it. My son never got the books. But
yeah.
Senator Eldridge was trying to advocate for him. And as I said, the prison lied to Senator Eldridge saying that he was not on a restricted block when he was. Now, years ago, the same thing happened. And I contacted State Rep Driscoll in Randolph. Senator Driscoll, I don't know if he's a senator now or a state rep, but his aide contacted the Department of Corrections, and they told him the same thing, that my son was not on a restricted block. You know, I was so upset because they lied then. So Driscoll sent me a letter, and he said that he did not, because I asked him if he would be willing to put that in writing, and he didn't want to put it in writing. So when he sent the letter, he said that the next time legislative members or whatever, the next time they meet, they were going to discuss some of the ways to improve whatever the case may be. But they didn't mention anything about that department saying he wasn't on a restricted block. So they have found ways to keep him on restricted blocks. They've tried so hard to get him to double cell. They say they're going to transfer him to Norfolk, and then they transfer him to Shirley, which is just as far away from me as where he was before.
I'm so sorry for that.
The thing that hurts me.
Why? See, that's. I think that's so wrong. And you know, they do everything. I've even heard people at Bridgewater State Hospital, the family members, talk about how dehumanizing. You know how they dehumanize these patients. And one of the things, there was a family who had to have a legislator get them a visit after months of not seeing someone, their loved one with serious mental illness. And I wrote, I'm gutsy. I wrote to the administration and I said, it's deplorable. And I said, they know that I'm a spokesperson. They know that, you know, the family members confide in me. So, you know, I told them that the family members are saying that, you know, the loved ones are being dehumanized. And I said, when you separate those family members, you know, those patients from their family members, you know, in the realm of, you know, in the, while I was talking about dehumanizing, I said, you're dehumanizing them by separating them from their personal roots, which is what I mentioned to Tony. It's just so wrong. And there's, if I had to be very succinct and do my little 30-second elevator speech or one-minute elevator speech, you know, I would say FEMI stands for proper placement, proper care, and then family involvement and family communication. those are the critical things. Proper placement, proper care. That means that if they're people are in jails or prisons, they proper placement, proper care means they're not abused, and they're getting, you know, decent, humane treatment, and then family involvement. So we don't dehumanize them. They are still a part of the community. I heard one of the inmates at the hearing, you know, say because the visitation list is so limited, he is cut off from mentors, he's cut off from extended family because he can only have 10 people on his list. He's cut off from, you know, his cultural and spiritual roots. We have to stop, you know, separating them from their communities.
And you know what else I think, Donna, what they need to do is they need to house these people accordingly. You know, they just throw them in different cells. I mean, like right now, he's on a cell with a lot of young people, and he's 55. He's going on 56, you know, and disabled. But he's now in his 50s, and they put them on blocks with people in their 20s. And, you know, and I think they do it purposely in some places. In California, they put up, pit gang members, rivals against rivals, and they put them out in the yard and they watch them, and this is their entertainment. In California, it's very, very bad, but we have to look around the country at these areas where there's in these prisons, there's a lot of gang members, and they need to house gang members in on different blocks or in different prisons. They need to house first time offenders on in different blocks or different prisons. They need to house the mentally ill in different areas, and the wrongfully convicted. They need to house the elderly, because in Massachusetts, and I know this is around the country, in Massachusetts there are people in their 80s and 90s who are terminally ill, who have Parkinson's, who have dementia, who are in wheelchairs, you know, and these people should not be in prisons on blocks and areas with other people. They should be in separate places to protect them. But it's a matter of entertainment for our penal system. It's a matter of entertainment. And I don't know
how people live with themselves. You know, how do they go home to their families, and what kind of family people are they, you know, when they can brutalize other people and just be cruel? Or even just to, you know, if they're not the cruel person, just to allow it by not speaking up, not having the guts to speak up.
I want to say something else, too. I want to say, I feel for, and I'm not going to say her last name because I think she might be in your group, and that is Susan. I want to say I'm sorry that her son ended up committing suicide. I want to say to Holly Alston in Pennsylvania, I want to say that I'm sorry her son committed suicide. You know, and there's so many others. Van, I'm not going to mention Van's last name. She's not from Massachusetts, but she's in the States, and she just lost her son. And Mary, she's out of California, and her husband was killed by some prisoners, and she believes that her husband was set up by the prison guards or officials. So there's a lot of people that are hurting. I think she has a lawyer, or she was going to get a lawyer on it. But these are the kind of things that are happening in the prisons. And I feel so bad for these women, especially mothers and you know, wives and you know, it's just pathetic that we have, like you said, these people that are supposed to be overseeing, but getting so much joy out of bringing misery to the lives of these incarcerated individuals, most of them who were, prior to going in, were victims themselves. And those that are still victims because they're mentally ill or they're sick in some other way. It's sad, but that's...
We do need to get, you know, there are bills pending. It's just such a long process to get any bill passed and then to get the financing. But there are bills pending, you know, for oversight in the prisons. We really need those independent oversights. It is good to have, you know, the Disability Law Center as oversight. But then once we get all these horrible reports, you know, the lawmakers have to be willing to get those changes that the reports tell us. But we need that kind of oversight in these, you know, institutions.
Please. I'm just so fed up with it. You know, I can see, like he says, America's like this, and it's gotten to the point where I feel anger towards our government. You know, and this may be why I don't get any responses anymore from any of the government officials, legislative members, or whatever. But when you are trying to get help from someone, anyone, throughout the years, who's this? Hello. Good. I'm doing a show right now, so would you like to join us? We have about 4 minutes. We've been talking about Tony, and we've been talking about these problems in the prisons. And Tony called, and he had a chance to speak his piece. And I sent pictures on Facebook for the family members to see. So if any of you are interested in coming on for this last few minutes to hear what's going on, feel free to do so. Huh?
I said I can listen.
Okay. Do you want to say anything? Let me turn the volume up, Donna. This is my son's aunt, one of my son's aunts, and she's going to be listening in. So, Donna, do you want to, again, state your name and let the audience know, everybody know about your organization and how they can reach you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Leona. I'm Donna Winant. I'm the founder and director of Families and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness. So that's FIMI, FIMI, and we advocate for those who are justice involved. And these are people with serious mental illness. We're working to get them a continuum of care. We're working to keep them out of carceral institutions. They're not criminals. They have a serious mental illness and lack of support services, which led to, you know, psychosis, all of these traumas led to the justice system, and we want to get them treatment, not punishment. Treatment, not punishment. They don't deserve to be punished for a disease they did not choose. So we're working for a continuum of care, and we're also mindful of the whole population of incarceration. We know there's a lot of abuse and a lot of neglect and a lot of lack of dignity, and we look for humane treatment all around.
Thank you, Donna. And again, I want to thank Donna Winant, because Donna has done a lot of good. She has been trying to work with the Bridgewater State Hospital, Prison Hospital. She's been trying to work with the Department of Mental Health. She's been actually working with Franz Dow, again, former warden out from Amsterdam, and Franz Dow is very, very, very fond of you, Donna. So, one of the things I want the audience to know is, if Donna can do as much as she's doing with her organization, all we ask of all of you is to try to call in, try to volunteer. In volunteering, you can do it at your time, you know, do it at your pace. You can do it from the comforts of your home. You can make calls to the legislative members. You can write letters. You can do the research, try to research, so that we can expose all the injustices that are going on in the penal system. Again, I tell the audience to please go on the internet and type in "God's caught smuggling drugs into the prisons." You will see who's bringing the drugs into the prisons. Type in WellPath contracted prison provider, over 1,000 lawsuits filed against them, some of them for the death of prisoners, some of them permanent damage, as they did with my own loved one. And some of them that are, like Donna said, you can find WellPath on the internet, and under all these lawsuits, you'll see what's going on. Donna, I would like to continue this again if you have time. But what I was going to say is, if you can be on the show on April 2nd at 2:00 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
It's on my calendar. It is on my calendar. I plan to be there.
And we have an advocate. She's been an advocate for some time, and she has a loved one inside. She's out of Texas, Gloria Salazar. She will be on with us, and Franz Dow will be on with us. Gary Cohen will be on with us. Marion Jacobs will be on with us, and so many others. So please, audience, put it on your calendar. April 2nd, at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and you're going to listen to a lot of professionals talking about the need to reform the prison in the U.S. prisons. And this is what we need to do, because we have 2.3 million people incarcerated, men, women, and children. And we also have a lot of abuses, as Donna said, deprivations, provocations, torture, and all of these things. We need to start looking at doing something about the American prisons, because it's becoming like a concentration camp, and it has to stop. So thank you so much for listening in. Donna, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you. And you like I told Franz, you like Franz Dow are loved by so many people for your activism and what you're doing. So I appreciate you, and I thank you so much.
Thank you, Leona.
We will now be ending this episode. Thank you all for listening in.